does Henri Rau mean gathering? What does Henri Rau mean?
Means a lot of money for Butte.
I've never gotten a definitive explanation of what Henri Rau.
The gathering, though. I mean, they always kind of refer to it. Uh-huh.
I don't know if we're a little too loud. Say
M.
No, say something else because I just need to be able to hear you.
Okay, this is...
This is a test.
This is a test. Gather it up.
Okay, Joan, tell me something. Is this a test?
This is a test.
Perfect, thanks. Okay, good morning. This is Mary Catherine Downey. I am the interviewer for The Gathering. And I'm gathered here with Diana Porter and Joan Porter at Diana's new home in Butte, Montana. And we are about to begin a collected oral history interview for the Irish in Montana. So let's begin. First of all, Joan, what is your name?
My name is Joan Porter.
And what is your location as far as your lifestyle right now? Where do you live?
I live in the flat, and so I've lived there for probably about 25 years, down in the flat.
And would you explain to us what is the flat?
Well, it's a part of Butte that is the opposite of the hill. It's the flat valley part that runs from the bottom of the Butte Hill out to the highlands, and it's the part that developed much later in Butte's history.
Than the earlier part on the hill?
Than the earlier part on the hill.
I see.
It was always referred to anything south of the front street was the flat.
And now you live in the flat?
Now I live in the flat.
And where and when were you born?
I was born in Butte in 35.
In the hospital in Butte?
In the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Which hospital was that?
St. James.
And did you have any older brothers or sisters?
No, I was the oldest.
And do you have any younger brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have a younger brother who is 2 years younger, and he's deceased. And then I have a sister who is 7 years younger.
And she's very much alive?
She's very much alive and lives in Butte on the hill.
Okay, where did you grow up?
I grew up on North Main Street, just above St. Mary's Church and across the street from St. Mary's and the Stewart Mine.
And would you call that your family home?
Oh, definitely. It was my grandmother's home, mother's home, my aunt's home, our home, and then my brother's home after we moved out.
Is the structure still there?
It is.
Mm-hmm. Is it still a home?
Please?
Does someone still live in there as a home?
Oh, yes. A person from Washington State bought it, and he bought it because he really liked the house, and he has done extensive remodeling on the inside, and it does look the same on the outside.
And we'll be taking a photograph of you and your sister, and we hope to do that in front of this home. Is that correct?
I would hope so, yes.
What was the address when you lived there?
709 North Main Street.
And is that still the address there?
It's still the address. It was always referred to as 709.
And how long did you live in 709 from your first days there until you first left?
I left when I went to college, and that was it. I was 18.
And where did you go to college?
I went to college at St. Mary's College in Leavenworth, Kansas.
And before you went to college, did you go to high school here in Butte?
Butte Central. And I was fortunate enough, I think, to be able to go 2 years to the old Central, which was back of the courthouse, and then 2 years at the new Central.
And where is that?
That's down on Park and, I'm not even sure.
Down by the KC?
Across from the KC. Mm-hmm.
So the old Central, was that where the county jail is?
No, it was right on the corner. Well, like the county jail is there now. The new one is on that corner where Central was.
Okay. And what did they tear that building down?
I think eventually that they did.
That must have been kind of different to go two different schools for your high school education, but it was the same basic school. You were at Girls Central High School.
It just transferred down to... The one thing, just as an aside, is that we really, once we moved into the new Central, there were so many rules and regulations for keeping it nice and keeping it clean and keeping it this. And at the old Central, we didn't have to worry about all that because it creaked and it was all wood and, you know, it was crowded and, you know, you just worked more at home in the old Central. But then it was like moving into a new house and we had to observe so much that people really didn't enjoy the new school as much.
Too many regulations.
Did you have a cafeteria in the old school?
Oh, heavens no. We had to bring our lunch and then we ate in the study hall. Uh-huh. But you could go home. I mean, a lot of people could go home for lunch too, you know, because of the location. But
did you wear a uniform?
We did wear uniforms.
Was it similar to the uniform that you wore at the new school?
Oh, yes. We just kept the same jumper, the same white blouses, the same blue sweaters.
How long did girls at Girl Central wear that uniform, I wonder?
I don't know, because the pictures in the hallways were of the other uniform, which was one dress with the white collar and the tie in front. Those were the pictures in the hallway. And then we went to the jumpers, and then I don't know if they ever... just quit.
Yeah, jumpers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then you went to college. What year did you go to college?
I went from 53 to 57.
And did you get a degree?
I did. I have a BA in sociology.
And then what did you do once you graduated from college?
From there, I went to the convent, the SCLs.
What's the SCLs?
Sisters of Leavenworth. Sisters of Charity of Leavenworth.
And where was the convent located?
Well, the mother house was there in what was called Xavier, Kansas, which is just the college right outside of Leavenworth. And so the mother house was there, and that's where I went to the novitiate. And then after that, I was sent to Catholic universities to get my master's degree in social work. And then from there, I went out to St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica, California. And I worked in the what was new for the hospital, the Kennedy Child Study Center, that was established there by the Kennedy family. And so I worked there.
What years would that have been?
Oh, Mary Kay. Let's see, I went to college from 59 to 61, and then I was out at St. John's from 61 to 66.
And then where did you go?
Then I went to St. Mary College and taught sociology for 2 years.
That's what location? Where is St. Mary's College?
That's the one in Leavenworth.
Okay.
Or Xavier, really. It was called Xavier, but it's connected to Leavenworth.
In Kansas?
In Kansas.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you teach there?
I taught 2 years. And then from there, I took a leave of absence from the convent, and I went to Ireland for about 18 months, 2 years.
And then what?
Please?
And then what?
From Ireland, then I came back, and then my mother was ill, so then I just stayed home and help take care of her. And then after she died, I stayed on for a year at Warm Springs State Hospital, living here in Butte and living at the home with my brother and sister.
Were you still on a leave of absence or had you?
No, I had left once I was in Ireland.
Okay.
I took the leave of absence for 1 year and then I decided that I would leave, so I left when I was in Ireland.
Now, why did you go to the convent in the first place?
I think that probably if there had been a Peace Corps, I wouldn't have gone to the convent. No, because it was like wanting to help people and to do that kind of work, that reached out to people and help people that had less than I had or that needed help. And so actually the convent seemed to be a way to be able to do that. I knew I couldn't be a nurse, and I knew I didn't want to be a teacher. So that was sort of a choice, even though it was a teaching corridor. I don't know what I was hoping for, but I went anyway.
And why did you leave?
Well, it's kind of complicated, but it was because we had the Vatican Council with, with Pope John, and things changed, and there was great opportunity then to be able to do more outreach with people. And those years that I was at the college, which was really politically pretty conservative, except for a few of the sisters there, but they just really resisted the change. And I just really got to the point and thought that, it's not going to change. I mean, we're not going to change it. We're going to spend so much time discussing how we're going to change that we're not going to do this reach out that we could do. And I think having a social work background was more of an impetus to try to do that. And I could just see that it wasn't going to happen. But I really didn't want to leave. But it just seemed like I wasn't going to be able to do what I wanted to do.
Joan, is there something about your upbringing in Butte that made the convent that appealed to going to the convent? Do you understand what I'm asking? Something about how you grew up in Butte that made going to the convent maybe the perfect thing to do, or certainly a top choice in what you did?
I'm certain. I mean, there's the whole religious background, but I think, having gone to school with the sisters too, and I've always had good experience with the sisters. Other people say they've had bad experience. I've never had any bad experience in terms of relationships with the sisters, all through grade school or high school. And so you did see some, that really gave you some indication of what you might be able to do. So I think the education system that I went through had a lot. And then I think there was a cultural approval of going to the convent or the priesthood that exists in Butte. Mm-hmm. That it was sort of a benefit to a family or a prestige or something if somebody in the family went to either the convent or the priesthood.
Yeah.
And I think there was a lot of support from my mother. I mean, she never pushed me, never, ever. But
she was proud of you.
She was proud, yeah.
She loved belonging to that, mothers of sisters or whatever they were.
Oh, she loved that.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, she loved going and visiting with the sisters and the other mothers. I don't know if they ever included the fathers, but the mothers of the sisters of charity. There was a great club here in Butte.
Yeah, and the sisters treated them like queens.
Oh,
because they had produced, nuns.
Yes. So there were a lot of young women your age or close to you in age who had gone to the convent from Butte?
I went later. I finished college first, but many went maybe after the first year of college or out of high school even. But there were a lot. And there were, a lot of sisters from Butte in the order.
So it was pretty socially acceptable, or even beyond that, it was something special to have a cleric in your family.
It was, really.
I wonder
more so for if you had a priest, but a nun was okay.
Yeah. I wonder where that came from, that pride in having someone in the priesthood or the convent.
I don't know. I didn't pick that up in Ireland. But I think that was an alternative. I mean, for people in Ireland, to be able to go to the seminary. I mean, I think that had some prestige to it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the place that religion held in people's lives, and the recognition that, one of your children is going into the church in some way, because the church was really very important, I think, in our family.
It was somewhat of a social center, certainly, at St. Mary's, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And I think I can recall, you know, going to high school and that.
Here, wait a minute.
All right, we're back on now. And so what were you saying right then, Joan, before we lost contact? Do you remember?
Oh, just the importance of the church or religion or their Catholic belief in Butte was very strong. And I was just going to mention that even when my father died then and we moved back to Butte, that Mother went to Mass almost daily on her way to work. That was just part of her routine.
Yeah. We moved back to Butte. Did you live someplace else?
During this one of the strikes, then we moved to Cooley City, Washington, and my father worked on the Grand Cooley Dam there. Then he died suddenly of a heart attack. And so we were only there, not even a whole school year, and then we moved back to 709. Everybody comes back to 709.
How old were you when your dad passed away?
I was in the sixth grade, so about 12.
So you were raised in a single family, single parent family almost.
We were, definitely, uh-huh.
I didn't realize that. Okay, one other question on your background. What jobs have you held that, other than what you've told us about so far? I think you got us through your teaching at the university, and then you went to Ireland, and you came back.
And worked at Warm Springs.
At Warm Springs for one year. Then I taught social work at the university, or in Bozeman, for about, I guess, 7 years. Then I went from there, I went to the University of Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh for a doctorate. Didn't finish my dissertation. Came back and went to work for an employee assistance program for a while. And then I headed that up briefly. Then I went to Salt Lake and worked for a managed care, just to learn what managed care was all about. That was a program for providing observation of people in mental hospitals. And it was working basically for insurance companies. And I only worked there 6 months just to learn it. Then I came back and went into private practice as a social worker here in Butte.
And is that your present occupation, or are you retired?
I retired from that, but even when I was working in private practice, I worked at the community health center doing therapy there. And so after I retired, I worked 2 days a week. I continued to work there until just this last December in 2009.
And so you're now fully retired?
Fully retired.
Mm-hmm. What do you do with your retirement?
You know, I would really like to say nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, people always expect you're going to be really busy and you're going to keep active and you're going to keep... But I do all that. I do a lot of reading. I've got a few groups that I go to that, you know, for mental stimulation. I go to conferences with my sister. For mental stimulation. Mental stimulation is really important for me to keep up on. Just, you know, learning new things all the time. I think I could have been a professional student if life had worked out that way.
What do you attribute your love for learning?
I would say my mother. Really, she really put a lot of value on education. And I think my mother was really very smart, basically, and never had a chance to go to college or, you know, to have a profession. And she just thought that that was very important. And I think to the point that she mortgaged the house for me to go to college. And I think she mortgaged the house for Diana to go to college. So that's how much education meant to her, that we would get a good education.
Yeah, there's no question after high school we were going to go to college. There's no other choice.
Yeah.
It wasn't because I felt as the oldest I should stay home and go to work and help support the family. And she just would not hear of it. And we had some knockdown, dragouts, fights over my staying home and my going to college. And she made sure I went to college.
But deep down, it was also something you really wanted to do.
I think so. Oh, yeah. I really enjoyed learning.
Yeah. And still do.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Still like to learn something new.
Well, Diana, you piped in there and said that you have that feeling that we're going to go to college no matter what, right?
Yeah, there was no doubt.
So why don't you tell us about...
And it had to be Catholic, though, too.
You had to go to a Catholic college?
Yeah.
Why was that?
I don't know. If you went to the University of Montana, it was like going to the devil or something.
My mother called
it... The devil's den.
My mother called it the den of iniquity.
Can't be Catholic.
That was before I got my degree from the University of Montana.
Yeah.
Well, tell me now, you were born in Butte, right?
Correct.
When were you born in Butte?
July 31st, 1942, at St. James Hospital.
And did you grow up here?
Yes, I did.
You went that short time to Washington?
Coulee City in Washington.
Yes, that's true. I was 4 years old when our father died. Yeah.
What do you remember of your dad?
Not a whole lot. There's a story that is probably unfortunate to remember. We lived in Coulee City, which were Quonsets. We lived in Quonsets, were kind of that rippled roof over, you know, the where you were living, and it projected out, you know, from the building. So there was like a little inset of within each Quonset. So one night he was sent out to call me to dinner. And I thought I would have fun by hiding behind each of these Quonset huts, you know, the part of it. And so I had a neighbor's dog with me. And so I'd peek around and see where he's coming, then I'd jump over to another one and hide and that sort of thing. And so finally he found me. And going up the steps into the house, he gave me a swat on the butt. And I'd never been touched before like that. And I cried, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried. And I can remember Mother saying that I, you know, upset the whole dinner, that my father was upset because I cried so much. And the dinner was ruined.
So did you cause the dinner to be ruined, or did Dad cause the dinner to be ruined?
Well, it was kind of a mixed. I made him feel guilty. Mm-hmm. So it's a strange memory to have, but I do remember how that was such an unusual event. It was just a single swat on the butt, mm-hmm. and it was just so traumatic, you know.
Well, I don't think physical abuse was part of our growing up.
No.
That was probably something that you would remember.
No, I never was hit. Like, I never was. When people talk about that, I can't remember.
My mother could control us with a look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That seemed to be the way we were.
Or silence.
Yeah.
That worked too, huh?
Yeah, no, that worked too.
Tell us about your education, Diana.
Okay, well, I went to St. Mary's School. A little bit like Joan at Girls Central, I went half of the 4 years at the old St. Mary's School, which was a three-story building, I guess. Actually a fire trap when you look at the pictures of it now. And then finally they built a new St. Mary's school, so the last 4 years at the new St. Mary's.
And the new St. Mary's was located where?
It was located in also part of a mine yard, and so we walked into a fenced area, which was kind of asphalt, you know, sort of place, yeah. But it was considered nice compared to where we had been.
And it was right next door to the mine.
Yeah, it was behind. Yeah, next door to the mine, behind where the old one was. But I don't remember that, you know, sometimes people regret losing some of their old buildings. I don't remember any regret over the old St. Mary's.
That was pretty dilapidated
place. It was, yeah. My mother and my aunts and uncle went to school there. So that was decades, you know, before me.
They were really old. Yes, really, really old. Yeah.
So when you graduated from St. Mary's, then you went to?
I went to Girls Central, and we also wore uniforms. It was the jumper with white blouses. I think I had two jumpers throughout all of high school, and I got to be pretty shiny by the time I was a senior. But that was an investment to make, so, sure. You know, the blouses were the ones that we changed every day, but the jumpers, I think, got cleaned only sporadically.
I think the uniforms were very influential in leveling status and economic levels in the school, because everybody wore the same clothes.
Mm-hmm. And then on First Fridays, though, we got to wear our own clothes. Uh-huh. Remember that was very special, because we also got to go to school a little bit later, because we were expected to go to Mass on First Friday. And we'd often walk down to Gamers and have coffee and a donut before going to school. Mm-hmm. And it was a trust system, where we went up to the cash register and put our money in, rang up what our...
No cashier.
We put in the money ourselves in the cash register.
Well, that brings up a couple of questions regarding the uniform and the leveling of the economic situation. If you had to categorize what your living standard was growing up, looking back now, how would you say what living standard you would fall into? Were you middle class, upper middle class, wealthy?
No, we probably weren't even exactly middle class.
We were below that.
Yeah.
Because we lived on our mother's salary, and women got paid.
Yeah, she was making only something like $200 a month.
Yeah.
What did your mom do?
She had different jobs. She worked as a bookkeeper in the liquor store, state liquor store. She worked as a clerk in one of the offices in City Hall. Mm-hmm. She worked in one of the county offices. They tended to, you know, the public, those kind of public jobs, they would give generally to widows, you know, not married women, but to widows. So she was in a number of these jobs where it depended on a political person being elected and being in charge of making appointments. Her last job, she worked for the marshal's office as a deputy marshal. What's that, Moser?
So, but the comment was made, the women were not paid as much.
Mm-mm, no.
But they were paid in political jobs, they were paid a little bit more than they would have been paid in other jobs, because I know she worked for Gagan, was an attorney, and it was outrageous what she was paid. I can remember just being furious when she told me how much she was being paid for how much she had to do. But she really worked hard to politically so that she could get into jobs, because it paid more.
Sure.
And I think they had more benefits. I'm not sure about that part. But
yeah. But even then, she was only making like $200 a month.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then had
Social Security. And Social Security at that time, because for us, under our father, as children of somebody
who was deceased.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole concept of economics, was that important when you were growing up? Did you feel deprived? Did you feel like a leveling should be necessary when you go to high school because other kids had so much more than you? Or did you have any feelings that way at all?
I didn't. It was just sort of everybody, especially in St. Mary's, were pretty much in the same boat. I mean, maybe a couple of people were affluent within the parish.
I didn't know them.
There were the McGonagalls.
Yeah, the Moriartys. Well, what's his name? Renwald. Went to St. Mary's.
Yeah,
he was St. Mary's. They were company people.
Right. Yeah.
And then the ones on Anaconda Road, I can't think.
Well, that was later, Hannafin.
There was another one.
Yeah.
Vados, or no, what was their name? They lived on Anaconda Road too, though, in the mine yard.
In one of the big ACM houses.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But generally, you know, we never thought of it. I mean, we were all pretty much in the same boat, I think.
And I think actually when we went to Central, at least my perception is that most everyone, you know, St. Lawrence, St. Mary's, St. Joe's, were pretty much in the same economic level. I would say probably the people from some of St. Patrick and IC were considered from more affluent families.
Those people from the west side.
From the west side.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it wasn't just a perception. They were, you know, but it wasn't like they had that much influence on how you thought of them, but you thought of them as more affluent.
Uh-huh. And the other thing that you brought up was the cash register, the open cash register.
Mm-hmm.
What about the concept of trust growing up in Butte? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, well, let's see. I guess, you know, trust among each other. You know, of course, there was always the Anaconda Company where things mysteriously disappeared from their yards. But I mean, among each other, there was trust, yeah.
What are you talking about?
Well, it goes way, way back.
Tell me what you know about what you think you're talking about.
What is it that Harrington said to you that he never had gone into a hardware store? He didn't know that you had to buy nails. You were supposed to buy nails.
They come from the Anaconda company.
Right.
Most of the plumbing, most of the electricity.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, with trust, I guess it was just, you know, we didn't quite have, well, Mother was always careful in the sense of, you know, she probably even had a sense of small children alone a lot. And so there was at least, when I was little, I always had to ask permission from some adult to even leave the yard so that they always knew where I was, you know, that I wasn't falling down, you know, a mine shaft.
Somebody
or
checking on
into
you.
The, yeah, so there was that.
What about locking the house, locking the car, you know, leaving things around, bicycles?
We didn't have a car growing up. Bicycles, actually, we probably always stored in the cellar. We had a key, but where the key was anybody going up and down the street could see you reaching for the hiding place because it was on a little shelf in the playhouse.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So we did, but we did have a key. Yeah. And Mother did, whenever we were going out and we're going to come back, at night, always made sure there were lights on. So any prospective burglar would think somebody was at home.
Mm-hmm.
So we always had lights on in the house.
So there was that protection.
Yeah.
Mom obviously was very protective of you kids. Huh?
Yeah, and given that she had to work and be away from home, mm-hmm. you know, to make sure, too, that we were... And we were on a busy, for Butte, a busy thoroughfare on Main Street.
Yeah.
And people walking up and down the street and the mine across the street.
And now as you sit here in your own home, you can see that.
Yeah, right, can see the street.
That's just
yeah.
fascinating. It's uh-huh. a beautiful view from up here. We'll talk about that. But now, when you were growing up, did you have a sense of being different because you didn't have a dad?
Only occasionally, like when you had to make something, you know.
Dad wasn't there to help
you? Yeah, or we'll make something for your dad for Father's Day or... Mm-hmm. Something of that sort, yeah.
Joan, you were shaking your head.
Well, actually, many families had fathers who were sick. They were either down at Galen or they had died. I mean, you grew up with, you know, a number of people who didn't have fathers. So
yeah.
It didn't seem that strange,
it was,
you know.
It was pretty common, wasn't it, really, when we think back on it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How many widows were
yes,
there?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Did you know the term widower when we were growing up?
No.
No.
Not that I, yeah, I mean, that wasn't there were single men, but you didn't think of anybody as being a widower. Yeah. No.
But widows was a common.
Right.
Term.
Widows.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was.
And the Babcocks. I mean, Mary Babcock, as far as our neighborhood, I played with Patsy and Rosie mostly, and of course, their father was dead, so mm-hmm. it was, you know, something that you knew.
And then the Dobles' dad was dead,
mm-hmm.
and then the Hugheses, their dad was ill. You know, so, I mean, it...
So it wasn't really a unique situation to be a family with mom raising us.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's kind of a unique thing about Butte, though, for, you know, nowadays they have divorce and dad's
yeah.
gone,
mm-hmm.
but there were a lot of widows raising kids.
Definitely,
when they grew up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
yeah. Or they were sick.
Uh-huh.
The fathers uh-huh. were sick and
so
couldn't
mom,
work. Yeah.
So the mom was the provider.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, we diverse. Diane,
yeah.
what kind of an education did you have after you left Girls Central?
Okay, after Girls Central, then it was going on to the higher education we were talking about that was required. And so I went to St. Mary's, partially because Joan had gone there, and I waited too long to apply to Gonzaga. So, but they took me at St. Mary's. So I went to St. Mary's and graduated from there with a degree in sociology. And then... do you want me to go on from there in terms of...
Please.
And then joined what was called Extension Volunteers, which was a bit like Vista Volunteers. And Vista is the domestic version of the Peace Corps. So I went into Extension Volunteers, which was for the Catholic Church. And...
Where did you go with Extension?
Actually, strangely enough, they sent me to Wyoming. Because I joined thinking, you know, a lot of what the volunteers did would teach in inner city schools and you know, do, you know, social.
So you thought you were going
work.
To the heart of Detroit? And
yeah,
you ended
right.
Up
and they sent me to Cheyenne to be with the diocesan CCD office because they were establishing it. And for some reason in their decision, they thought, well, a Westerner would fit in well
mm-hmm.
in another Western state for that position.
How long were you there?
2 years. And I traveled around the state a lot, worked with priests around Wyoming. Most of them were Irish-born. It was kind of almost like a missionary territory for them. But established CCD programs in helped, you know, in parishes. But lived in Cheyenne with some other volunteers.
And then where did you go?
Oh, let's see, that takes me up to 66. I came back to Montana and went to work for Catholic Charities as a social worker in Helena.
Oh, indeed. There was a story that I remember you telling me about working for Catholic Charities. Did you have to do with adoptions?
Yes, it was almost exclusively adoptions.
Okay.
And at that time, the Great Falls Diocese didn't have a Catholic Charities, so our Catholic Charities covered the whole state. And we placed...
So what's the story about your delivering the babies across the state? And
uh-huh,
having,
yeah.
Did you have a flat tire or something? What's that story?
That was when I had 3 babies in the car.
Uh-huh.
I was coming down from Great Falls, yeah, and had a flat tire. And I don't know how they all happened to be in Great Falls. Usually we placed the girls in Miles City because there was a Catholic hospital there when they needed to leave, you know, their community to have them for the pregnancy. But I was coming with 3 babies in the car, newborns, and had a flat tire between Great Falls and Helena. And some guys stopped to help me, and he looked in and he said, oh, you have a baby. Oh, you have 2 babies. Oh, there's 3 babies. So then he gave me and the babies a ride into town and then managed to get them into the foster homes where they were before placement. And then I had AAA go back and help, you know, get my car. Yeah.
Well, the aspect of the story that I recall that you don't seem to be focusing on now, I guess, because time has passed, was he was not only good looking, but he was single and he was very interested in this young woman driving this car until he spotted the fact that you had three babies in the car.
I remember,
when you told that story, it was like...
I don't remember that part. I remember as being older. So, you know, different memories.
I guess it's your life change.
How I told the story, yeah.
So how long were you with the Catholic?
Until 69, I think. And then I came, that's when Mother was ill. So I came to Butte and worked for Family Service Center, which was a Model Cities project.
Living back at 709?
Living at 709, yeah. And then Joan had come back at that time. Mm-hmm. And then I guess, was Porter divorced at that time? Was he living at home too?
Oh, he was living at home too.
Okay, so we were all at home when Mother was sick, yeah.
And then what was your next employment?
Ah, golly. After Mother died, then I decided to go to England just to live in another country for a while. So I went and lived in England for about a year. I had a cousin there on the Porter side married to an English woman. So I stayed with them.
In what city?
It was outside of London. It was in the county of Kent. And the little community was called Ashford, Kent. So I stayed with them. But I couldn't get a work permit from the British government. So then I eventually traveled some, went to Russia, and did a little bit of traveling on a Eurail pass, and then came back home. And then I don't know what I did. Maybe that's when I went to graduate school in Texas.
Where in Texas?
Denton. It's north of Dallas.
And did you get a graduate degree?
Yes, I did. That was in gerontology. So I got a master's in gerontology, and then I
Why did you go into gerontology?
Well, I was a social worker here in Butte with Family Service Center. At that time, it was just sort of the beginning of nutrition programs and senior centers, but it was very early years. And a lot of younger people had moved away from Butte and left a lot of older people behind, and without that much, just the beginnings of some services for seniors. And so I thought, well, you know, people deserve better when they get old and make contributions. So I'll go into that field to try to make some changes.
So you actually went into gerontology so that you could come back to Butte?
No.
Oh. Okay.
Not necessarily. Well, actually, I was thinking of coming back to Montana. Uh-huh. I was thinking of being with the State Office on Aging or something of that, where you could make some changes. I thought.
What did you do after you got your master's degree?
Then I got a field placement. We had to do a field placement. So I got one with the Senate Special Committee on Aging in Washington, and just loved that. I liked policy and that sort of thing. So then after that finished, I did a little consulting for a while in D.C., and then I came, you were at the university in Bozeman.
Bozeman.
And there was a small grant for this person to, with the gerontology program, to hire someone. So I spent a year there with that program. Then I went back to Washington. Oh, and then, I went back to Washington, but I actually got a job in Houston, Texas, with a geriatric psychiatrist who had gotten a grant to set up a mental health and aging project. And so then I went to work there, and I stayed in Houston, gosh, 3 or 4 years.
And what work were you doing there? What was the nature of your work?
That was at a medical school, and it was developing a curriculum for different health professionals, or helping professionals, working with somebody in that field. So that we developed a series of videotapes on these different fields, working with older people and, you know, their conditions and presentations and that sort of thing. So did that, finished that program, became a director of a foster grandparent program while in Houston, and then...
You wrote a book, too.
Yeah, with this geriatric psychiatrist, we put together a book.
Oh, what was the book?
Something on gerontology and geriatrics, but I...
Having written it, I
cannot
remember
it
the name.
It was so long ago, yeah. Well, it was, we edited it. It was what it was, and different people contributed the chapters.
Uh-huh.
Introduction to Gerontology and Geriatrics, something like that. It was a textbook. Then while I was with the foster grandparent program, I started going to law school in the evening. And eventually... finished up with the foster grandparents program because I wanted to go to law school full time. Got a part-time job with Cambodian refugees, a relocation program there, while I was finishing. And then I went back to Washington, D.C.
Well, did you get a JD?
Yeah.
So you graduated, what college? Or?
It was Houston College of Law, I think. South Texas College of Law is what it was. Yeah.
And then you went back to Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C.
And what did you do in D.C.?
And went back to working. At that time, Senator Melcher became, there was an election, I was 86. Senator Melcher became chair of the Senate Special Committee on Aging. So then I got a job with that the committee until he lost his election in 88. And then I worked for different aging organizations, the National Council on Aging, then the Older Women's League, and then I got the opportunity to go to Macedonia in 1995. And that was for a USAID project to help the government set up a private pension system in addition to their social security system. So I stayed there for 4 years.
Did they succeed in setting up that?
Yeah, they did, yeah. So then in 1990, I came back to Washington and then stayed there until I retired at the end of 2007.
And you continued to work for OWL and some of the other programs while you were in Washington?
Oh, when I came back from Macedonia, I worked for another aging organization called the Alliance for Retired Americans, and that's where I retired from.
And when you retired, then you returned to Butte?
Right, I did.
Why did you do that?
I always planned to come back to Butte, yeah.
Why?
Well, just that this is home, you know, this is where Joan is, our brother, you know, his children. And also, I couldn't live in Washington on a retirement income anyway. I mean, I love Washington, but I didn't own property there, and the rent was too high for a retirement income.
You could do that here?
Oh yeah.
Why? Why can you live in Butte on a retirement income where you cannot live in Washington, other than the property thing that you mentioned?
Well, property, I guess that's it mostly. Mm-hmm. Is, you know, what it costs. Mm-hmm. And property or rent is a big part of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, as the two of you, and I'll ask each of you this, but as you look back on your life, you've traveled extensively, right?
Mm-hmm.
How is it that you were, well, let's say, first of all, the wanderlust, how is it that you wanted to travel? Where did that come from, or do you know?
I don't know, because for the longest time, I didn't want to travel. I didn't have an interest in it. And I think I read a book. It was one of those feminist books when I was about 30, and there was something in there that said, you know, where you are when you're 30, you're going to be the rest of your life. And I thought, well, I don't want necessarily that.
Maybe I'll go live in London or Macedonia or someplace.
So I better get moving. You know, it was sort of like a philosophy, you know, mm-hmm. is that if you haven't moved on by the time you're 30, you're not going to move on, you know. And I remember that hit me in particular, and I can't remember what book it was. It wasn't like Fear of Flying or something of those, something along those lines.
Oh, be darned. How about you, Joan?
I think I always had the idea of just moving on all the time. I think that was part of even just going to the convent was... they didn't stay in one place all the time. And so I saw that as a way that you didn't have to stay in the same place.
Join the army, see the world.
Sort of thing, yeah, I suppose so. But I've always liked, you know, to travel. And I don't know, I think it was more like not wanting to stay in one place too long. I don't know if it was travel so much as not wanting to stay in one place.
But the one place you've stayed in more than anywhere is Butte.
Is Butte. Just kept coming back to Butte. I'd leave and come back to Butte. And it always reminds me of the Irish, especially when I worked in Ireland at a drug treatment program. You know, the young people were always going to London. They were always going to England because the facility with the drug program and all that. And then, but they couldn't stay away. They kept coming back, and even if they would get in trouble because of their drugs, they'd come back, and then they would be in trouble and that, and then they would go back to England. But it just seemed that, you know, that coming back, you always came back, and I always think of myself in that way, some way, with Butte, is going and then coming back. And then Diana's, through gerontology, was involved with a group of women who traveled to study aging in different countries. And so actually I just kind of coattailed on this group and traveled with them to all the different countries, you know. Yeah. So it wasn't like going to live like I had done before where I'd move and live, but it was traveling. And it's always been an interest.
Now, in your travels, the two of you have been back to Ireland more than once, many times.
Went just this past August.
For a family reunion?
For a family reunion of extended family that we never met before, yeah.
So do you feel that there is a root in Ireland, like there is a root in Butte for you?
Yeah, well, I think part of it might just because of relationship, our fondness for Dermot. You know, who is a cousin there and still lives on what was the family farm. And he's been over here a couple of times, and then we've made trips over there. So it is sort of, you know, we know him as well as you can know anyone.
Your relatives.
Of your relatives, yeah. And it's just sort of is like going home whenever we do go there because he's still there.
Where in Ireland?
It's in the Allahies Parish, as they call it. Bracloon is that little township or town land or whatever they call it. But it's on Barra Island, or Barra Peninsula in County Cork.
And Allahies is where the copper mines were, isn't it?
Allahies is where the copper mines are, yeah. And then he lived, and we visited in 69, that house, the house that he still lives in, that he lives in now.
Oh, be darned.
Yeah.
And so you do go back every so often?
Yeah, this year, and then I was last there in 2005. Okay. And then we had a family reunion in 97 there.
So when you say that was the family home, what family are you talking about?
Okay, this would be our grandfather, Eugene Sullivan's home.
So is that paternal or maternal?
Paternal. But then our grandmother also came from that area, but she came from Iris. And the house she grew up in is still there, although it's used as a cow shed, you know, sort of her down.
No, I was going to say it's not occupied by the family, but it's used as a cow shed.
Yeah, and somebody else owns that house. But our cousin Dermot owns the paternal. I'm sorry. By paternal, it is maternal. It's my mother's father.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get at. Now, your name is Porter.
Correct.
And your father was Eugene Porter.
No, our father was Harold Porter.
Oh. So Eugene?
Our grandfather was Eugene Sullivan.
Okay, and your brother is Eugene Porter.
Right.
Okay. So your father was Harold?
Harold Porter.
And your mother was?
Josephine Sullivan.
Josephine Sullivan Porter.
Yeah.
Okay. Where was Porter born, your dad?
He was born in Dickinson?
Yes.
Dickinson, North Dakota.
And was he of Irish ancestry?
partially. His mother was Irish, first generation Irish. Her father was born, came from Ireland.
Do you know what part of Ireland her father came from?
I'd have to go look it up.
You've never returned to that family home?
No, it's a bit more remote. I mean remote in terms of having been in contact. Yeah.
What was her maiden name?
Coleman.
Oh, okay. So then the Sullivan is the Irish connection that you've actually made the connection
with. The largest connection with, yeah.
Okay, now in your words or however you want to word it, tell me who your mother was as far as her ancestry. She was Josephine Sullivan.
Right.
But
she,
who was Sullivan?
Okay, she was the youngest child of Eugene and Johanna Sullivan. And Eugene was from Allahy's Parish. Johanna was from Irish Parish. So they both immigrated separately. They didn't know each other in Ireland. They immigrated separately.
When was that?
Our grandmother probably came, I think, as a teenage girl somewhere in the late 1880s, mid to late, and went to Fall River, probably Massachusetts, initially. I don't know about Eugene's, how quickly he came out to Butte, but the two of them got married in Butte in 1897. And they had five children, three daughters first, and then a son, Eugene, and then the youngest was our mother, Josephine.
So four girls and a boy.
Four girls and a boy, but the boy was killed in the mines when he was 22.
And your mom stayed on and married Harold.
Yeah.
Did your mom travel a lot?
No, other than wherever Joan was, she'd go to visit.
No matter where. That was the benefit of my being
We made trips to Kansas. She went to California. Wherever Joan was, it was an excuse to go visit.
Besides the facts of dates and names, what do you know about your ancestors' lives in Ireland?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. They came when they were pretty young. Our grandparents came when they were pretty young. They came from large families, both of them, but especially our grandfather. There might be 9 or 10 of them, and most of them came out to Butte, immigrated out to Butte.
Do you know why?
I think it was that they would have come in the late 1880s, early 1890s. There was a period where the copper mines in Allahy's shut down for a few decades, so there was no work. There was only one son that got the farm, so they came out here.
Why Butte? You know, why not Washington, D.C. or Houston, Texas?
Well, I guess, again, it's because of the copper mines, is that there was experience with working in copper mines in Allahy's and then coming out. Some, not necessarily in our family, I think some people stopped in Michigan to work the mines there, but eventually came out to the copper mines of Butte.
So they've always been, ancestrally, they've always been miners.
Well, at a certain point I can't go back any farther because I think they would have been probably farmers also, but at least there was the mines there for a different source of income.
Do you recall, as you sit here today, either of you, stories that they would have related to you, I guess your mother would have related to you, about the ancestors' life in Ireland?
You might remember more.
Mother talked about her mother, and her mother had really kind of responsibility in the family, I think, for taking care of some of her brothers. And so mother just remembers that, you know, her mother telling her, and we would could go to the same strand, that her mother would just go down and walk along the strand just to get away from all of the kind of family responsibility and all that. And she would walk along that same strand that we walked,
oh, really?
You know,
uh-huh.
And that that she would just kind of look out, you know, and see leaving as maybe an answer for the situation. Uh-huh. And so that's, you know, what she had, that responsibility, my grandmother did. And then with regard to my grandfather, I think it was just picking up and visiting the family homestead, you know, that they, it really was pretty much a hand-to-mouth kind of existence to have that many people in the family. And, you know, having the farm, which would be somewhat cattle, sheep. They used the sheep and they used the common areas, you know, to have sheep.
But also, Joan, do you have any memory, or did Mother come up with any memories when Mother made one trip to Ireland and you were with her then?
Mm-hmm.
Did she have any, you know, did that conjure up any stories that she had heard while she was there?
Not too much. And part of Mother had cancer at that time, you know, and she had just been, had treatment and that, and had come to Ireland at that point. But I really had more of a sense that she was, she talked about her mother a lot more, you know, and things that she used to do and how hard she worked. Then when she came here, but then she talked about that strand, you know, she mm-hmm. did that, and she walked around, you know, she spent time at the house. But it was more kind of an internal reminiscing, I think, for Mother, just, you know, remembering everything.
To go back to it.
Yeah, just to go back to it. And she really, that meant a whole lot to her, to go back to where her mother was. But we did go down then to where Pa lived, which was down on Cahermore, or on the peninsula. And that's where then we had the relatives. There were no relatives as far as with her mother's side, but with her father's side. And she loved that, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but she talked about a little bit, but it was more like her doing her own reminiscing on that trip, not talking about so much.
But you were sensing what she was experiencing as,
yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. Well, that must have been special.
It was, really. I think it was very special for her, uh-huh. you know. And I think in some ways, since she was so ill, and I think she just knew she was going to be dying, that it was very special.
And somewhat of a catharsis, too.
Yes, a full circle.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, the name is Sullivan, right?
Yes.
What do you guys know of the source of the name Sullivan?
Oh. Yeah. Be prepared.
All right. You know. Okay, Joan, you tell me what pass the baton.
No, actually, there's, thanks to Rio Bardo Dwyer, who's a genealogist on the Barrow Peninsula, he says that it comes from the, it's, well, actually, I'm jumping ahead because it's O'Sullivan Cumba in terms of setting aside the O'Sullivan part. But the...
Okay, now don't lose me.
Okay.
What's O'Sullivan Cumba?
Okay, well, there's different, like, tribes of O'Sullivans or whatever.
Okay.
And they will have a second name. So, like, ours was O'Sullivan Cumba.
Oh, say, in contrast to O'Sullivan Driscoll or O'Sullivan Porter or O'Sullivan Moriarty.
Well, not a different name exactly. A lot of it had to do with what they did. It was... or where they came from, or something like that.
So what about the Cumba?
The Cumba is based on a French word for combat. And so apparently that O'Sullivan strain of the clan fought with the French when the French came to try to help the Irish. Uh-huh. Or I guess alternatively, they would have gone to France to help the French, you know, battle the... whoever.
So the strain of the Irish that is Sullivan, Kumba. From your aspect of Sullivan, is Kumba.
Kumba, yeah.
And was,
but many people, many, because O'Sullivan Bear was the great chieftain.
Yeah.
And so he was really the hero in reality and almost mythically. But families just took the name O'Sullivan after mm-hmm. him. And so then that's why it became so important to be able to distinguish
which O'Sullivan you're talking about.
You were. So then that's where they have all of the designations afterwards. You're O'Sullivan Kumba, you're O'Sullivan something. But it was because so many families just took O'Sullivan's name uh-huh. after, you know, he became the hero.
It's certainly a common name in Butte.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you're not necessarily related to all the Sullivans in Butte.
No, no.
Mm-mm. And so you
kind of know the difference. I think Bolo Sullivan, they were Sullivan Bolos or Bolo Sullivans or something like that. Oh. It wasn't just that individual. But I think, related to you, yeah. But I think the Bolo was another distinction in the Sullivan
oh.
name.
So then, so Sullivan was the big chieftain. That
yes.
was where the name originally comes
uh-huh.
from.
Uh-huh.
And then how long did your family, or do you know, have the O'Sullivan and then drop the O?
They seem to have dropped it when they came to this country. Uh-huh. And I asked Riobard about it once. Riobard has a kind of a list of barrel lists, I don't know if you're on it, that circulated, and I put that question, and he said he didn't know why, because O'Shea's also dropped the O, and they became Shays.
Uh-huh.
Some O'Driscolls did, but on the other hand, O'Donnells didn't drop theirs, O'Briens didn't drop their O,
huh.
but the O'Sullivans did.
Personal choice, perhaps.
Well, some speculated it was the English that made them drop the O.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's no definitive answer why they dropped the O. But they seem to, almost all, except for like Father Sarsfield O'Sullivan and Veronica,
kept the O.
They seem to have dropped the O.
Yeah. Now, has there ever been time when the different Sullivans would get together and set up, we are the Kumbas and we're the Bolos and we're the et ceteras? Or do the Sullivans just get together?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, is it, I guess in the genealogy thing,
yeah.
you go to Riobard O'Dwyer. O'Dwyer or Dwyer?
O'Dwyer.
O'Dwyer, okay. Does he separate them by that additional name on the Sullivan or on the O'Sullivan?
Uh-huh. He does in his three volumes.
Oh.
He will have in parentheses what the other name is
uh-huh.
for that family.
Did you ever talk to your mom about her name?
No, not that I can recall.
No, because our grandmother's name was O'Sullivan, and then she married an O'Sullivan. You know, I think she never, it just wasn't, there were so many Sullivans that you just didn't think of it as being
uh-huh.
unique, you
yeah.
know, in any way. But I think the designation was important, too, in terms of marriage and children,
uh-huh.
that they'd have to distinguish.
In Ireland, yeah.
In Ireland. So I wouldn't be surprised that, you know, the church had a lot to do with their getting some designations straight so that the marriage lines would be
yeah.
cleared.
Yeah. Now, when you guys were growing up, did you have a feeling of Irish ancestry in your home? You know, what
mm-hmm.
things about your home were Irish?
Well, of course, there was always St. Patrick's Day, which was a big deal, and the parade.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's Irish so much, but the hospitality. Mother used to host holiday dinners. And usually invited this couple who had no children, they
mm-hmm.
came, and then any relatives like Barb and any
mm-hmm.
relatives that came. But of the generation, my mother's generation, those people came. There was always highballs.
Yeah.
Or ditches, you know, they always had that socialization.
You're going to have to explain to this oral history machine what's a highball and what's a ditch. What are you talking about?
Okay, well, the ditch is whiskey and water. Highball is whiskey with something carbonated, usually. Okay. Yeah. I guess there's different choices, tonic water, seltzer water, or something.
So there was this sense of hospitality.
Hospitality, yeah.
And there was always liquor involved, or?
Liquor was always served. My mother didn't drink herself, so sometimes the guests would bring their own bottle, you know, knowing that. But I mean, it wasn't, she would try to have some on hand too. I mean, she wasn't against people drinking, but it's just she didn't drink herself. But she was a generous hostess, you know, if their glass was almost empty, she was refilling it, you know,
in terms of the
hospitality, yeah.
What other traditions other than the hospitality?
Well, I think I used to be with my aunts, my mother's sisters, Cynthia and Marguerite. Or not Marguerite, but Ev.
Somebody coming for you?
Yeah.
He can't see you, I don't think, because the...
All right.
I should...
we're back on.
Greet him.
No, he'll come later.
He's going to sit there? No, he's going to.
I know.
Okay. No, in terms of something that is unique that maybe Bernadette wants to pursue, is this book about how Irish women immigrated to America. And a lot of it has to do with, as they are on the East, were on the East Coast, but it's 19th century. And Irish women, more than any other immigrant women, became domestics, worked for other people in their homes. Mm-hmm. And it was a different pattern of immigration where they came not as necessarily as families, like Italians came as families, Jews came as families. Irish women came generally
as individuals.
By themselves.
Yeah.
And they found their own work, they found their own source of income, and you know, became pretty, not necessarily independent, but nevertheless. Well, he's coming up.
Okay.
The ancient ways.
So, okay, you were telling us about the women coming in as domestics.
Yeah, Irish women came, single Irish women came and had to find a living in the United States because they generally did not come as part of family groups like other immigrant women, such as Italians who, if they came, they came with a family. And if Jewish women came, they tended to come with families. And those families were protective in terms of the not having them work necessarily outside the home or in somebody else's home. But Irish women could do that. So there's an interesting statistic. As late as 1900, 60.5% of all Irish-born women who labored in the United States worked in domestic capacities.
Wow, and you're reading from what's the name of the book?
The name of this book is called Erins, E-R-I-N-S, apostrophe S, Daughters in America. Erins, Daughters in America by Hassia, H-A-S-I-A, R. Diner, D-I-N-E-R. And the subtitle is Irish Immigrant Women in the 19th Century.
And your grandmother fell into this category?
Yes, when she first came, as far as I know, she came as a teenage girl, maybe with her sister. And if this ship's log that I have is her, it says her future occupation is going to be working as a maid. So she must have worked in Massachusetts, probably as a domestic. But then she came out to Butte, married my grandfather, and in the 1900 census, she had two children, a sister-in-law living with her, but she also had a domestic servant.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was the domestic an Irish immigrant?
She was. Her last name was Leary.
Oh.
And then in the 1910 census, at that time, she ran a boarding house for minors. And then she did have also a domestic working for her, which, and then when our mother was born in 1906, she apparently was a sickly baby. So my grandmother hired this other young Irish woman to be a nursemaid to my mother. So in a sense, they were providing, or she was at least, and I think probably a lot of other women in Butte, were providing a house and a work for young, other young Irish women that came to the United States.
Wow, that's neat. That's a neat story.
It is, yeah.
Because you do hear about the domestics like Bridget in the...
Yeah.
In the Lizzie Borden situation.
Right.
The yeah. Irish immigrant.
Yeah, and they you know, were maids and they were cooks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of cooks, what special foods, if any, did you have growing up?
We were pretty basic. Mother worked, so she didn't cook much except on weekends. On weekends she liked to make, and it's still one of my favorite dishes, is a pot roast, you know, with potatoes and carrots, and it was something that could cook in the oven. Mm-hmm. And she also did stewed chicken and baked chicken, what it was called. She like kind of like one pot meals, mm-hmm. you know, she liked. But other than that, Joan was cook.
How did you learn to cook, Joan?
I don't think I've ever learned.
Well, you did take the cooking classes in grade school.
Oh, I took classes. But I think, too, with regard to some of the things Diana said, Katie, who was my mother's nursemaid when she was a baby, really was part of the family. All the time until she died, she was part of every family gathering.
And she was from Ireland, too.
She was very definitely from Ireland. She had a very strong brogue. She
never changed her clothes. I mean, she never changed the style of her clothes. She wore a long dress, great big lace collar all the way around.
So that, you know, it wasn't just like a servant sort of thing. I mean, she was family, and she considered herself family. And she was free with her advice to the family, so it wasn't that kind of a relationship. The other thing, when you were asking about Irish in the family, I think the cooking, Cynth was a great cook.
That's our aunt.
Our aunt. And she and my grandfather lived in the same house, 709, and with my father and my brother and my mother, we lived on the third floor of the house. And so Cynth used to do a lot of cooking, and she worked at Hanson Packing Meat Company. And so she had all kinds of ways of, she'd bring home, you know, pig's feet, and she'd bring home all kinds of fish to cook, all sorts of things, you know. So it was, but it was always very basic kind of cooking. Ev was a great cook. She was my mother's sister. She was a great cook, and I think they both cooked in the boarding house, but I think particularly Ev did a lot of the cooking. And in terms of other Irish features, I think it just struck me is that we had tea often, but we had tea every night. You always had to have tea and a cookie or tea and toast or something before you went to bed. It was just like, and it was just like when I lived in Ireland, those, you know, for almost 2 years, that was a ritual with many of the families that I knew, that you didn't leave the house without having tea,
yeah,
you know, in the evening.
They weren't coffee drinkers.
No. Oh, no. When I lived in Ireland, the coffee was terrible, but it's much better now. Mm-hmm. But the other thing I think that was, is the wakes. That was very much, I think that was in other nationalities, but I think in the Irish, wakes were really very important. And the wakes used to be held on the second floor of 709, because when they had the wakes in the homes were too small, because a lot were just miners' homes. But because we had the three floors of the boarding house, then they had wakes on the second floor, and people would come in the front door, and then they could just have the wake there, and then they had the kitchen downstairs for any kind of gathering as part of the wakes.
Well, tell me now, 709 was your family home.
Right.
But it was also a boarding house.
It was.
Was it a boarding house when you were growing up there?
No, when our mother was growing up, it was a boarding house.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's when they had the wakes. Do you remember attending a wake?
In the house?
In the house?
No, I don't think it was ever there, that I was there at that time.
But you recall stories about the wakes.
Right, and people, you know, talk about how hauntings, you know, and then people walk around and that, you know, and so, you know, Mother said, well, you know, that's possible. There's so many people that were waked here, you know,
sure.
But even after she died, you know, people have reported doors closing, windows opening, all that, you know, so.
Well, it's this big three-story structure.
Yeah, right, you know.
But there also was a young man that died in the house.
Uh-huh.
And so we always thought, I always thought if there was a ghost, it was him.
Uh-huh.
You never saw him though, did you, Diana?
No, but there's all, you know, the noises and everything. But it was a young man that was stealing some wood or coal from the mine yard and was shot. And they brought him into the house and he died there in the kitchen.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
And so it's certainly haunted or possibly haunted?
Possibly haunted, yeah.
Possibly haunted.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's accepted,
yeah.
You know,
uh-huh.
that it can be haunted. Then the other thing I think that was very Irish, well, I could be other nationalities too, is we visited a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mother would take us all, and we would go to Centerville to visit a friend of hers. You know, we would go down to East Broadway to visit. I mean, take the family. We would take the bus all the way out to the flat at that time to visit relatives, you know, and even take the bus to Anaconda for a day trip to go visit her friend or to visit a relative in Anaconda. So there was that connection with family. We went to our aunt's house down that had kind of a rooming house. We went to another aunt's house, so that there was always that visiting.
Family connections.
Family connections, maintaining family connections. And I think that was just part of how they kept connected, you know, with no phones. They just had to stay connected.
And the hospitality thing that Diane talked about,
mm-hmm.
and the socializing, the drinks and the wakes.
Yeah,
and
stories and anecdotes were always part of any gathering, too.
Yeah, and Synth and Ev used Irish terms.
Like what?
Well, I can't honestly remember some of them, but when I was in Ireland, I would sometimes hear people say something, you know, that would be just like you would have heard them say in Butte, period. But Ev and Synth used a lot of Irish, and I think, you know, they were probably around the borders. They were, you know, that was where they were, whereas Mother was more probably isolated because
mm-hmm.
of age and health.
Yeah, but Mother would say, and I don't know if it's exactly Irish, what they were called ejaculations, like Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, or, you know.
Oh, God, help us.
Well, yeah, those kind of, you know,
sweet
quick,
mother,
quick prayers.
Sweet
yeah.
Mother Mary.
Yeah.
Always the ejaculations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Prayers, perhaps.
Yeah,
yeah, perhaps. Yeah.
Do you guys have any family heirlooms or keepsakes, mementos that you consider valuable from the Irish?
We had the furniture and things that were stored in a warehouse that burned, so lost all of that.
Oh. Do you have family pictures?
Some family pictures, uh-huh.
Of your mom in her early years, or your grandma?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I got a wedding picture of my grandparents,
uh-huh.
and some pictures of my mother, and my mother
okay.
and my father. And
you know, they might be worth just maybe scanning and adding to the,
mm-hmm.
to the
I don't have
history.
A scanner, though.
Oh, I can do it. I mean,
oh.
It's not a problem.
Okay, but I can give you an idea if you want to take a quick look.
Okay.
Oh, let me see. Okay.
There's this, yeah.
It's their wedding
oh, yeah.
photograph, and then about 30 years later.
Oh, that's awesome. Let's add that.
Okay.
And is that a picture of St. Mary's School?
It is.
The old school.
And
we,
then the new one in the background. And
I
then
see.
This is a neighborhood picture. This is St. Mary's. It was about to be torn down. You can see some of the windows are already out.
Seemed to me when we were attending school, some of the windows were already
out. Yeah,
we
they were boarded up.
The third floor.
Couldn't go, no, you could probably couldn't. We I think first and second grade we could go this first, okay. Second, third floor.
This is, I think it might be taken actually from the original Gallus frame because it's looking down on Woman Street and here's Main Street. A little bit of our house. Here's my neighborhood now, Clear Grit, and then the school here.
Oh, excellent. Well, what we'll do is...
It looks like, doesn't this remind you, though, of New York tenement houses when you look at them from the back?
Lots of things about Butte remind me of some of the New York... The amount of brick. The amount of brick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then all of these, you know, apartment houses that were there. You kind of forget about that.
You know what? Let's do at the end of
the childhood
tape,
homes.
We'll look at these and we can label them and then attach them to your oral history.
Okay. All right. Okay, we will do that. Okay.
That's an awesome picture of the train trestle.
This?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, there's one life transition question that I like to ask you.
Thank you.
If you were to write the history of the Irish in Montana, what would you include for future generations?
Okay, it'd have to be more the Irish in Butte than Montana, because
yes.
We didn't have that much.
Okay, I'll reword the
Irish.
Question.
Okay, all right. Okay, the Irish.
If you were to write the history of the Irish in Butte,
What
would you include for future generations?
Okay, well, what I was talking about before in terms of women's roles, because, there's the book, The Motherlode, that does talk about different women, not just Irish women, but the role of women, because so many books of the history of Butte is about mining and the men and a little bit about the women, you know, who were bucket girls or something like that, but maybe not enough about the women of Butte and like this instance of supporting young single women coming over by hiring them as domestics.
And the number of widows who raised
their
families.
The number of widows
here?
Who raised families with who knows what kind of income they were getting by on. I mean...
And the political thing that Joan, you were talking about. Your mom knew who to talk to and what to say for the purpose of bettering herself and
bettering
her family.
Bettering herself, having better jobs, or whether they're better jobs, but higher paying jobs than... she would get just in the private sector, so that was really very important.
And then the associations. Mother belonged to the Daughters of Isabella and to the Business and Professional Women and went to their meetings faithfully, you know.
Did she belong to the Altar Society?
I don't think so, because didn't they take care of the church?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and see, she was working, so that wouldn't have been something she would do. But I mean, the other, you know, associations, it was important to have kind of, even then, that kind of support from other women.
And looking back at your own lives, the influence that the Irish women had on your lives made you basically what you are, the influence in education, in hospitality, in the ability to socialize, the whole thing in religion, how many really articulate Butte women do you know?
Probably lots.
Just about
everybody.
Yeah, really.
Because that's how we were raised.
The other thing I think there is, too, is an element of being independent and self-sufficient, that there was not, maybe because of so many single women, that women weren't cast into a particular role that they couldn't do things, that they had to do things, that so that you do get that self-sufficiency, that sense of growing independence, taking care of yourself. And I think that is part of, you know, growing up in Butte.
Definitely. Anything else?
No? Can we always do an addendum?
Yeah, you can always do an addendum. Well, we will do an addendum as far as the photographs and things.
Okay.
We'll add those. Now, you're not going to give me any originals. So I have one other document that says if you give me an original, you have to sign that. I'm going to make sure I make copies of everything so you keep all your originals.
Okay.
So we're good that way.
So are you going to do it here in Butte before you leave or what? Oh, you're going to